forever not turning this thing on. It's on and then it's not recording. So this is 23rd of September. I am Mike Law and this is James Steele. And he was a tech inspector with 121st. So your first tour in Vietnam, you were with
the 117th Aviation Company out of Quy Nhon, and then moved to Dong Ba Tin.
All right, and you had been trained as a 67N?
I was a 67N out of Fort Rooker and became a crew chief on a gunship, which was the Hog, had 24 rockets on each side.
Uh-huh. And you did that for?
I was with the 117th for a year.
Uh-huh.
And then was trained when, after completing in Vietnam, I returned to Fort Rooker, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And at Fort Rooker, I re-enlisted for Japan. And fortunately, or unfortunately, I was selected to go TDY en route to Vietnam with the first cab. So I went to Fort Eustis, Virginia for TI school.
And how long was that?
The TI school, I believe, I cannot remember, but it was 6 to 8 weeks or maybe 12 weeks. It was the 67W Whiskey TI school, which meant that you covered all of the helicopters at that particular time.
Uh-huh.
And so after completing that, I think I came out number two in the class.
How big was your class?
Probably 20, 30 people. And
yeah.
We was promoted to Spec 6. After
graduation.
After graduation. By coming out at the top of the class, you got the next rank. Constellation was you were also en route to Vietnam. And so I was assigned to the first cab in Vietnam, where we had Cobras.
Okay, and so when did you finish your TI training?
I would have finished the training in August of 1968. And then they would have sent me on a 30-day leave or 20-day leave. And then I ended up in Vietnam on September of 68.
Okay.
And so from 68 of September, I was with the first cab to 69 of, and then from September 69, I transferred to the 121st Aviation in Sa Trang.
So you were a TI with a cab?
With the cab.
Okay, and you were in Delta Company?
Delta 227th.
227th, and that was a gun company?
Yes, it was a gun company.
Okay. Now, specifically, a TI is not designed to turn a wrench.
No.
You're a quality control sign-off guy, correct?
Correct. Right. After any work on an aircraft, it has to be red X for the work to be done, if it's dealing with flight controls or anything of that nature. And then when you repair that, you have to have someone come back and validate that it is done correctly. And so that's the TI that does that. He comes out, he signs it off, and as a part of that, you also do the intermediate inspections. Every 25 hours back in those days, the helicopter had to go in for what's called an intermediate inspection. And then every 100 hours, it went in for what they call PE, a primary inspection. And so the TI is the guy who signs off that work when it's completed, validates that the work has been completed. Normally, a TI will do the initial inspection, write up all the things that they find wrong with it, and then another one will be the person who signs off all that stuff after the maintenance crew has completed it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as a TI, you are part of the launch crew in the mornings when the ships go out, and you're part of the launch crew when they come back in to retrieve them to make sure that if there's any problems, things can be taken care of so that the flights can go out the next morning.
Yeah, no, I understood that. So you had to know what was safety wired and what wasn't, and what the and you'd ask the kids that did the work, you know, what was the torque setting, or or that kind of thing?
You had to validate the torque settings to make sure the torques were correctly, not over-torqued or under-torqued. You had to validate that safety wires were safed properly and not
improperly.
Improperly, meaning a lot of times when you safety, a lot of kids would safety them incorrectly, which means they're loosening the nut rather than tightening the nut. So you have to validate all of those kinds of things were there. And also you may have issues where the pilot will write up a vibration of some type, and then the maintenance officer will come out and we will take a flight to validate what that vibration is. Also, after every maintenance, meaning PE, periodic maintenance, the maintenance officer will do a test flight. And on that test flight, the TI is usually the guy who signs off on the booklet as the maintenance officer is going through all the types of maneuvers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Such as auto rotation.
Yeah.
auto rotation is one of the keys that when you make sure that there's a problem, that you can always auto rotate by validating the speed of the rotors, etc.
Yeah, yeah. So you didn't do a lot of flying, but you did quite a bit.
Quite a bit. The way you'd get quite a bit is on the when I was in the first cab. We had Cobras, and when the Cobras would go out to work, we had a OH-6, which was called a Loach, that we would stand by in the event that we had problems with them or something went wrong. And you would be sometimes at a fire base if the aircraft's going to be out working all day, and you want to be close to where they are. But with the 121st, though, I did mostly it was in the hangar. And in the event that one had a problem, they may call back for the maintenance officer to come out. We would look at it, and if you had to ground it, then the maintenance officer would fly it back along with the TI.
Mm-hmm. And so you told me that there were four of you there?
At Sautrain, there I believe there was four of us. There was the maintenance sergeant, which became was a TI, and then there was another gentleman by the name of Manning, myself, and I believe there was one more, but I can't remember his name, though.
Uh-huh. And you guys had a regular schedule.
Yes.
And so, you know, you had to cover everything. Otherwise, nothing got signed off.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Now, they had other schedulers that would schedule the crews, and you didn't...
Correct. All you did is whenever they needed somebody, they would send up for the hangar, and a TI would go out and work the flight line. One guy would work the flight line when aircrafts are taking off and coming in, or when crew chiefs would do their dailies and they have an issue that's a red X, then they would call up for the TI, and you'd go down and sign it off when they repaired it.
Yeah, right. So was it, obviously, when you extended, you didn't mind the duty. You didn't mind being in Vietnam, otherwise you would have got out. But my point is, I guess you were done with Cobras, or?
No, what happened is I thought that I was getting out of the, seemed like when I was with the first Cav, the Cobras seemed to be a magnet. We got a lot of rocket attacks, a lot of mortar attacks, things of that nature. And since I only had 1 year to go, I felt I would go somewhere safe, and I elected to go to Sautrain.
Okay.
However, again, you're still in Vietnam, and Sautrain was the Delta, which I had been up north and in I Corps, and then I had been in the center part, and I wanted to see what the Delta was like. And so Sautrain was a good company that I had looked up, and I had a friend that had been there, and I elected to go there. And it was a good duty, good duty.
Mm-hmm. So, no super regrets or anything else like that?
None whatsoever. I must say my experience in dealing with the aircraft and the pilots and different people was well worth it. I wouldn't change a thing.
So, you walk in the door and you're obviously not new kid by any stretch of any imagination. You know, you're very experienced sergeant. So, you... somebody becomes your mentor to introduce you to the unit, or you just sit at the desk and the kids come up and talk to you?
I'm a specialist, Spec 6, and because I'm aircraft and I'm I like aircraft. I like helicopters. I like helicopters. I'm introduced to my platoon sergeant, and then from the platoon sergeant, I'm introduced to the junior NCO Hooch. And with that, then you become a camaraderie with the other TIs that are there, and just go to work.
Yeah.
Just start up and go to work.
And so, but at the same time, nobody, you don't know anybody, and they don't know you, so you gotta figure out whether you're going to trust the guy or not, or whatever.
Well, the deal is for me was that you have crew chiefs who crew those aircraft, and the pilots and the crew chiefs, they're a team. And I'm there for maintenance and understanding what that helicopter's supposed to be and what's supposed to be done. You have manuals and things that you have to deal with. And with that, you just do your job.
Yeah.
They assign you to do a initial inspection on an aircraft that's coming in for maintenance, and you go do it. And then when it's done, or if you're doing the final on another aircraft, you just take your sheets and go do the final and make sure it's done right.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to make sure everything is right.
Yeah. Now, there was almost every unit that I associated with always had bugs that never got resolved or had tragic results. Fred was just talking about them. They had a D model, and it couldn't pick up a load. It just, you know, it could start, did everything else I could think. But obviously the engine or whatever never developed enough horsepower to drive it. Well, it was ultimately crashed on the 8th of February of 68, and a lot of people died. Those problems were rare, but they were not hard. I mean, different crews would fly it, different crews would use it, and they'd write it up, you know, it has this problem or has that problem. And, you know, the maintenance tries to check it out, can't find it, turns the aircraft back over to be used.
Yeah.
That seems like it'd be, you know, a real ghost trying to chase a ghost, but they're real.
Well, for me, it's a machine, and a machine has certain criteria that it has to work to based on what the book says it's supposed to do. And as long as it's doing that, then you have to go along with it. However, I think what you're alluding to is when they started talking about Vietnamization and turning over the aircraft to the Vietnamese, etc. As a TI, you could see, or a maintenance person, you could see things that go wrong or where potential crashes or things could happen. Example, hot start. If you have a low battery, which you'll ask the pilots will tell you, if you have a low battery and you're putting in fuel into the intake, into the exhaust, and when it finally takes off, you're going to get what's called a hot start, where a flame will shoot out the back of the tailpipe, and you as a bystander can see, well, gee, that should have been a hot start. And if it's a hot start, that means you need to shut the engine down, turn it over to maintenance, and they have to do an engine overhaul, where they do the combustion chamber, because it's burnt up in there. Well, if you see them do that, and then they restart it and fly off with it after changing the battery, then you know something was wrong. Other examples are, you have a torque meter. If you pull too much torque, you're supposed to do certain things as a pilot. You know, you put it into maintenance to get that fixed. You know, blade strikes, things of those kinds of things, or you have the tail rotor, or they don't clear the bunker. Certain things you can tell is going wrong with an aircraft that should be reported that are not reported.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's doing Vietnamization. American pilots, I never encountered any time when they didn't turn something in that was associated with that maintenance had to take care of it. If it's a blade strike, they got rounds through the blade. You got to get them changed. Crew chiefs look at them, validate them. Round through the blade, simply just change it. You don't have to do anything to it. If it's a blade strike, then you may have to change the whole transmission, so you don't know.
No, I knew that. I also knew that Well, at least I highly suspected that the Vietnamese just, that Huey was way too complicated for them. Way, it's funny because they could fly jets, they could do other things like that, but they didn't do the Huey well. And I talked to several people that were pressed into that service, and it was a politically incorrect joke. It really was. And so I was actually surprised they had anything flyable, even though they started with brand new airplanes. So virtually brand new ones. So yeah, avoiding that one was probably a good
smart thing, a good
surrender tactic.
But basically, though, as a TI, though, I enjoyed my work, enjoyed working with aircraft, and admire the pilots and crew chiefs that flew all the time.
Yeah. Right. So at that point in time, when you leave the 121st, you've been a TI for well over 2 years, and so did you stay in the Army?
No. What I did then is I got out of the Army and I went
right away or?
Right away. I get an early out from Sot Trang, directly out.
Oh, okay.
And I went to A&P school with the anticipation of going to work for TWA.
Uh-huh.
And after A&P school, I got hired by Lockheed Martin.
Uh-huh.
So that's how my aviation career ended, per se, but working for them for a contractor on the outside.
Uh-huh.
I worked for Lockheed Martin for, 37 years.
Oh, really?
37 years, but in 1974, I went back into the reserves with the 336th Aviation Company, which was the sister division to the 121st at Sot Trang.
Okay.
And did 20 years.
All right, so 20 years in the reserves.
20 years in reserves and six active.
And then, and that was good. And where was that? Here in Georgia?
No, in California.
It was in California.
Yeah, the 336 was located at Los Alamitos, California. And it became the 121st, I think. It became the 214th. Later on, the 336 became the 214.
Uh-huh.
But I did, and then I was transferred by Lockheed from working at Burbank, California, to Marietta, Georgia, in the C-130s and all of that. And from there, I was transferred to Fort Worth, Texas, when Lockheed acquired General Dynamics.
Mm.
And so I went down there for 5 years and then came back to Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
That's my 37 years. Mm.
And so what kind of work would you do for Lockheed? Like, so you're an A&P guy, which says, you know, I can do lots of different things. And
but I hired in with Lockheed as a... I was a supervisor for what they call manufacturing operations on the L-1011,
okay.
Final assembly. So got promoted from that, then I went to the S-3A program.
No. So your job, how many people were working on that, MD-11?
Okay, on the L-1011, yeah. I had a crew of 18 people.
Yeah.
And so from there... on the L-1011, when it stopped, yet so many structures and so many electrical people. And so I went to the S-3A program when the L-1011 went down. And on the S-3A program, I had a crew of 18 again. And then from there, I got laid off.
Yeah?
Yeah. Got laid off for 3 months. They always had a big shutdown at around Christmas time. So then when I came back, I was already in college, and after that I went into procurement, contract procurement, and became a subcontract administrator. And then from there I became a hotshot corporate negotiator. And from there I became a compliance manager. For contract compliance.
Mm, yeah.
So that's my 37 years.
All right. I was talking to a guy the other day that was in Vietnam. He was a crew chief on the Chinook.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And he owns a company that does very specific maintenance, and he says that he was working on an L-1011. And I was a big, I liked the DC-10. I thought it was a fine airplane. As it turns out, its economic profile got a little ragged at the end of its life, and United wanted to get rid of them so badly because they were really a financial dinosaur. But, you know, they hauled a lot of people a lot of places, that's for darn sure. And I thought the L-1011 was a good successor to it, but it never took off very much. I don't know how many of them they built, but not many. But I was shocked. This guy said he's working on them now. I don't know how many of them still fly.
I'm not sure either. The one key element I did leave out of my talking to you, the reason I hired in with Lockheed is I was familiar with what was called the Cheyenne helicopter.
Uh-huh.
Lockheed had been contracted to build the Cheyenne, and this was before the Cobras. However, it became so expensive and overweight that they canceled the program,
right,
and the Cobras took off.
Yeah,
that was predecessor to that. But back to the L-1011, good aircraft, just got costly. And that's I think that's the reason that it didn't survive.
I don't know if it was costly to operate or whatever, but
it had the Rolls-Royce engines.
Yeah,
had three of those on it. And back in those days, the marketing was that it took three engines to go across the Pacific or the Atlantic,
uh-huh,
whereas now you can go with two engines.
Oh yeah!
Back those days, they had to have three.
Yeah.
The L-1011. One of the things unique about it was marketed as a class, I want to say class three, landing aircraft. In other words, where it could land, take off, and land by itself. In other words, you could take it off, program it, it would land, go to the next airport, wherever, land, and then you would only have to tax it in. So if it was fogged in, you could actually go in and land.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that came up later.
Yeah. But it was a giant airplane. there must still be some kind of special purpose cargo liner or something today.
I imagine. Well, I know that Pat Roberts,
uh-huh,
he bought one, which was the 700 Club. I don't even remember them. I don't know about them. But anyway, they had turned theirs into a hospital aircraft.
Yeah.
Where it had all of everything.
Yeah.
You got it all?
Yeah, right.